Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Senate finally rolled out its climate bill today. We've also got catfish and international trade on the broadcast. And how is global warming like nuclear weapons? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at Elance.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 12th of May, and it is good to have you here. After more than a couple of fits and starts and a political hiccup or two, the long-awaited Senate climate bill was officially introduced today. It's a biggie, 1,000 pages that are going to touch almost all of the American economy. The hope is that it's going to overhaul U.S. energy policy and cut our greenhouse gas emissions at the same time. That is no easy thing to do, so the bill does something interesting. Not all polluters are treated equally. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The bill would impose new limits on carbon dioxide pollution from utilities, factories, and oil companies. But the political climate in the Senate is rough, so the bill's sponsors, Democrat John Kerry and Independent Joe Lieberman, decided on a gradual phase-in. Dan Esty teaches environmental law and policy at Yale.
They've decided that it makes sense to move to a hybrid approach that begins with a fast start in the utility sector and then rolls out more slowly across other industries.
The government would pass out free pollution credits to utilities starting in 2013, but they would eventually pay for them. If utilities cut their pollution and had credits left over, they could sell them on a regulated trading floor. Chemicals, steel, cement, and other manufacturers would get their free permits in 2016, and they could sell leftovers too. Steve Cochran is with the Environmental Defense Fund. He says the market for pollution credits would be limited to permit holders. The idea is to keep out speculators just there to game the system.
And so the idea that we'd be creating a big new trading system for the entire economy just didn't seem to make sense.
Oil companies would not be allowed into this market. They would have to buy carbon credits for their refineries. If they didn't use all of their credits, they couldn't trade them. Cochran says that keeps the market small enough to regulate. And oil companies are on stronger financial footing than utilities and manufacturers, so can afford to pay for their permits from the start. Scott Siegel disagrees. He lobbies for utilities and oil companies.
There is no industry in the United States that is more adversely affected by the legislation than the domestic refining industry.
Siegel says oil companies would pass the cost of the permits on to consumers, and he says gas prices would go up. There's one thing Siegel does like about the bill. He says it would be much easier to deal with one federal program than many state ones that currently exist. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Now that we all know more about Greece and Europe and their economic problems than we would care to, here is a different but related question. What is going on in China? Yesterday, we heard inflation there was up nearly 3% last quarter. Today, it's rumbles in the stock and housing markets. Property prices in Beijing have dropped 31% over just the past month. And a graph of the Shanghai Composite Stock Index looks like a cutting-edge roller coaster. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more.
It's no surprise people get riled up over the news from China. Investors have been worried for ages that China's economy is overheating, that there's a bubble in its real estate market, that its stock market's going crazy. Richard Drobniks at the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business, and he says we've got good reason to worry about China.
China has become the engine for the world economy, and we should be very happy that the Chinese economy is growing quite well.
He says the U.S. depends on China to buy our treasury bonds, which helps keep interest rates low. And China's an important trading partner, too, and not just with us.
Our exports to China are important, but our exports to Indonesia and Malaysia are important. And those economies are stimulated by the Chinese economy.
The Chinese government's well aware that its economy could overheat. It's been taking all kinds of steps to keep the situation under control, tightening lending to slow growth and cooling down the housing market. Victor Shi is a political scientist at Northwestern University. He says the ups and downs in the Chinese market's nothing new. He says in the short term, things look pretty good.
I think this year the growth is set to be at a relatively high level. Consumption, at least according to official figures, is growing at a pretty healthy clip. And also export actually is picking up again.
He says in the longer term, China does have some big challenges. It has to figure out how to make itself less dependent on exports and foreign investment. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Oil has been gushing into the Gulf of Mexico for 23 straight days now. BP has said it will pay all legitimate claims, a phrase that's going to take armies of lawyers to define. Louisiana residents have a history of fighting for damages and tougher standards after disasters like this one. Hurricane Katrina is another good example. Often the armies of lawyers that it takes come from law schools, but a new bill kicking around the Louisiana legislature would limit what those law students can do. Eve Troe reports.
The website for the Tulane Environmental Law Clinic includes a long list of accomplishments. This year, it's blocked construction of a coal-burning plant and kept an industrial park off coastal wetlands.
When we have a victory, it's that some project that violated the law either didn't happen at all or it went forward, but with much better environmental controls.
Lisa Jordan is a lawyer at the clinic. She says plenty of private attorneys line up to sue for damages after an accident, like the BP spill. Her staff is there to help make sure it doesn't happen again. Louisiana State Senator Robert Adley says the clinic's success comes at a high price.
A great deal of action taken by the law clinics has resulted in the loss of jobs and economic development for the state.
Adley is behind a bill that would strip all state funding from any university whose law clinic sues a government agency or company. Even private schools like Tulane get a lot of state money for some programs. With oil flooding the Gulf, it might seem like a bad time for a bill that favors business. Yet Adley maintains Louisiana needs a business-friendly climate now more than ever. Lisa Jordan at Tulane says Louisiana needs a strong industry watchdog, too.
When there's no one else looking over them, a lot of things get overlooked.
Jordan says law clinics push agencies and companies to use best practices that could prevent future accidents. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Maybe traders on Wall Street have a collective case of amnesia. I don't really know. But whatever the cause, it's like last Thursday never even happened. The major indices are just about back where they were pre-crash. Do keep an eye on gold, though. The safest of safe havens is traveling at record highs near $1,250 an ounce today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Now that the energy bill is on the legislative calendar, we are going to be hearing more about global warming and how to go about stopping it. Strobe Talbot, the president of the Brookings Institution, says in a new book that the relevant comparison here is nuclear weapons and how the superpowers managed not to blow everybody up over the course of the Cold War. He says we ought to control climate change the same way. Get the big polluters on board first, and then you bring the whole world into it.
The United Nations is very important to this process, but it is a mistake, I think, to count on a group of 192 different countries to come to a consensus in a meaningful time frame that will allow us to take meaningful action. We need to count more on what the United States, the European Union, China, and India can do on their own, but coordinating with each other rather than a formal legally binding treaty. It would be great to have a formally legally binding treaty, but it just takes too long to get one.
Here's the thing, though. The Chinese and the Indians want economically what we and the Europeans have. And the way to get that is for them to grow and not necessarily to constrain their carbon output, their emissions of global greenhouse gases. How do you get even those two to agree?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. That is exactly the dilemma. But the trump card here is self-interest. India and China both have a self-interest in licking the problem, or at least, as we say, mitigating the problem of global warming, because they are themselves so vulnerable. In fact, both of those countries, and they know it, are already paying a price in terms of the loss of arable land, the increased danger of floods and droughts. They are already experiencing the consequences of global warming.
As we expand this global warming control regime that you've come up with, what about the model of rich countries paying poorer countries to help them control their greenhouse gas emissions? Is that something that should continue?
Short answer, yes. There's got to be heavy lifting by the developing world, the poorer countries as well, but the onus is going to have to be kind of front-loaded to the developed world. And I think Copenhagen was a mess. It was an instructive mess, which is to say it made clear that insofar as there can be progress, it's going to have to be led essentially by those countries whose leaders met together on a completely kind of impromptu basis at the very end and rescued a bit of an accord out of what otherwise would have been a complete failure. And here I'm talking about President Obama, the Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao, and the Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. But if President Obama goes to the Cancun summit, which is the follow-up to Copenhagen at the end of this year, 2010, and still doesn't have American legislation, his ability to lead the international community is going to be greatly diminished.
What does it say that we in this country can't even get our act together, and yet you recommend us putting together some kind of big powers agreement on global warming?
Well, what it says is we got to get our act together, and we have to have kind of a breakthrough, not just at the level of our political leadership, but on the part of American civil society as a whole. Because if we don't rise to this challenge in the next maximum 10 years, maybe 5 years, we are really dooming to very, very hard times on a much less livable planet generations infinitely into the future. And I think that we have the beginning of a kind of what I would hope might even be a revolution in what you might call the global civics of this issue.
Strobe Talbott is the president of the Brookings Institution. He is the author most recently of a book called Fast Forward with his colleague Bill Antholis. Mr. Talbott, thanks so much for your time.
Delighted, Kai. Thanks so much.
BP is going to try again tomorrow to get a containment dome down to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. The company official said today it could be in place and trapping oil by Friday, if everything works out all right. On Capitol Hill, meanwhile, congressional committees are still trying to work their way through all the mutual finger-pointing that BP and its drilling partners are doing. Commentator David Frum says it's time for the oil industry to fix what went wrong and then get back to work.
It hasn't been the greatest couple of weeks for the offshore oil drilling industry. The next few months will be even worse. Congressional investigations, huge cleanup costs, new regulations. The offshore industry must change. One critic of the industry compares the big oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico to the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island. Three Mile Island forced the nuclear industry to adopt zero-tolerance standards for accident and mistake. The drilling industry must now accept the same zero standard. But the rest of us are also going to have to accept this. Offshore drilling remains as necessary as ever to America's energy security. In 1970, the lower 48 states produced almost 10 million barrels of oil per day. Today, the lower 48 produce a little more than 3 million barrels of oil. It's Alaska and offshore oil that sustain the United States as an important oil producer. And as oil production in the lower 48 continues to fade, the United States will depend on Alaskan and offshore oil more and more. The Energy Information Agency estimates that offshore oil production alone is on track to overtake lower 48 land production by the 2020s. Without offshore oil, the United States will soon end its days as a major oil power. Americans cannot accept the end of U.S. oil production. Already, too much of America's oil, too much of the world's oil, comes from dangerous sources. Some say, we cannot drill our way out of the problem. Okay. But we cannot import our way out of it either. Agreed, conservation and innovation can reduce demand for oil. We've seen it happen before. After the oil shocks of the 1970s, Americans cut their oil use sharply. Not until 1996 did American oil use again catch up to its level of 1978. But oil use will not fall to zero anytime soon. And so long as Americans use oil, they should want to produce as much as they can, from land and from sea.
Commentator David Frum is the editor of Frum Forum. Your thoughts are always welcome. Just go to marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, catfish everywhere.
If it were regulated by USDA, all of a sudden that importation would stop, would potentially stop on a dime.
But first, let's do the numbers. There was a nice little bounce on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials rose 148 points. That is 1.3%, ended at 10,896. The NASDAQ added 49 points, 2%, 2425 at the bell. The S&P 500 gained 15 points, 1.3%, closed at 1171. Morgan Stanley shares dropped 2% today amid reports that it is the subject of a federal investigation. The question is whether the financial firm's own trading desk bet against the same mortgage-backed securities it sold to investors. Tech companies helped fuel today's rally. IBM surged 4.5% after projecting a big jump in its operating profit. Cisco saw a slightly smaller increase of 3%. Bond prices sank. The yield on the 10-year T-note floated up to 3.57%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Constant Contact, working to help small businesses understand what social media can do for them. Learn more at ConstantContact.com/social media. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases import and export price index data for April. The Senate Armed Services Committee holds a hearing on operations in Afghanistan. And about 20,000 people are expected to attend a candlelight vigil at the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial in Washington. The annual event honors police who have died in the line of service. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We're going to start letters today with the housing industry, one woman's take on it, and frankly, part of why there was that boom and then the bust. A lot of you wrote about my chat with author Megan Daum and her book about the ups and downs of searching for that perfect house. Bill G. wrote from Morristown, New Jersey, to say that he identifies with Megan's need to find that house, but he does wish she'd gone one step further in her reflections.
That perhaps she had learned something from her mistakes like I did. There are much more important things in life than owning a crumbling piece of infrastructure in the vain hope of turning it into your dream home.
Our story about state budget cuts in public schools got some letters. Best estimates are that 300,000 teachers and staff members across the country might lose their jobs as a result. One thing that's going to happen as a result of that is bigger classes. Nothing, says Jared Van Loon of Kirkland, Washington, to really worry about.
When I was in elementary school, the smallest class size I was in was 32. Yet I still graduated from university, have a good-paying job, and feel that I am well-rounded.
The chairman of the Washington Post Company said last week he's thinking about selling Newsweek. It was taken as just another nail in the print media coffin, fighting, as it is, what looks to be a losing fight against digital. Richard Shore from Albany, New Jersey, doesn't believe it.
How about train stations, Greyhound bus stations, subway stations, crowded city blocks? My point, there will always be a marketplace for the hard copy media of this world.
In our Mother's Day commentary, Betsy Stevenson pondered children as measured against happiness. Does having them make parents happier? That touched a nerve among parents and non-parents alike. Will Schreiber of Ely, Nevada, offered this.
Asking a mother, knowing what you know now, would you still choose to have kids? Can be like asking a politician if he supports a government-sponsored day of prayer. Society at large will only accept one answer, and you definitely don't want your children to ever suspect that they are less than the sum of all your ambitions.
If you have a comment for us, or a critique, or a question, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. You know those stories you hear about people getting cell phone bills in the hundreds or maybe thousands of dollars? People whose teenagers thought nothing of downloading a movie onto their smartphones or who got carried away texting? Well, the Federal Communications Commission has heard those stories, too. It says it wants to find a way to let consumers know they're in trouble before the bill shows up in the mail. From Washington, Brett Neely has more.
The FCC calls it bill shock. Here's one of the complaints it recently received, read by a member of Marketplace's staff.
My bill suddenly tripled in 1 month. When I got to looking it over, I noticed they had charged me for my mobile-to-mobile minutes. They had advertised free mobile-to-mobile.
The agency may ask cell phone carriers to send customers a text message when they begin to run up big bills or come close to their monthly data limits. It's similar to what's already required of European companies. The industry says customers can already find out how many texts they've sent or how much data they've used for free on their phones. But Joel Kelsey with the nonprofit Consumers Union says the information they provide is too technical for most users to understand. He wants
not just information about kilobytes, but information about how much would it cost in dollars and cents to download a song.
Chris Gutman-McCabe is a lobbyist with the Wireless Association. He says if you do get an eye-popping bill, you should call your cell phone company and ask them to remove the charge.
And in the overwhelming majority of those cases, the customer and the carrier come to some sort of understanding.
But that doesn't always work. The Boston Globe recently profiled a family that's been fighting an $18,000 bill with Verizon for 4 years. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
We got the March trade deficit numbers this morning. The imbalance between what we're importing and what we're sending overseas is at its highest level in almost a year and a half. A trade gap in and of itself isn't a great thing economically, but today's report is being seen as a sign, generally speaking, of a rebounding economy. How you feel about international trade kind of depends, though, on what you do for a living and where your competition is coming from. The American catfish industry is a real good example of the complicated relationship between government regulation and a global economy, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
At Washington's Georgia Brown's restaurant, Chef Jim Foss says catfish is a popular item.
Well, it's definitely a specialty here. We go through a lot of catfish.
Foss uses only domestic farm-raised catfish, and out on the Lowry Aqua Farms in central Arkansas, they're trying to keep it that way. On harvesting day, three men in waist-high water guide a net full of wiggling, whiskered catfish toward a grappling hook on shore. A crane lifts the net and dumps the fish into water-filled tanks on an 18-wheeler. These slimy creatures are headed for restaurants and supermarkets around the country. Farm overseer Charlie Mears tracks the size of the haul from his mud-splattered pickup. He has some advice for a city slicker from back east.
If it looks wet, don't step in it. That's what you can expect.
When he got here 10 years ago, nearly 80 ponds held catfish. Now that's been cut in half. Mears says Asian imports are taking a bigger and bigger bite out of U.S. production. For specifics, Mears refers me to the boss, owner Joey Lowry. I caught up with him at home, bag-packed for yet another trip to Washington. He's president of the Catfish Farmers of America. They're trying to get catfish inspections transferred from the Food and Drug Administration, which oversees seafood inspections, to the Department of Agriculture, which inspects meat. Lowry says while the FDA relies on spot checks, the Agriculture Department performs daily, continuous inspections.
You know, they're the best we've got. USDA is the best we have to inspect food.
Lowry says the FDA's cursory inspections are letting contaminated fish into the U.S. market.
You know, I have a fear if the foreign fish is left unchecked and it keeps coming in here, it could bleed over into the domestic industry.
He says unsafe foreign imports will scare customers away from all catfish. Hearing those complaints, Congress ordered the Agriculture Department to take over catfish inspections. The National Fisheries Institute, which represents importers, says this move is designed to cut off sales of cheaper, safe imported catfish. Gavin Gibbons is their spokesman.
If it were regulated by USDA, all of a sudden that importation would stop, would potentially stop on a dime. And there's no demonstrable evidence that it would improve food safety.
He says it could take years for foreign catfish producers to adjust to USDA regulations. But the department, which has never inspected any kind of seafood before, is struggling to come up with rules for catfish inspections. Byron Trulio, a former FDA seafood safety official, was hired to help the rulemakers.
The USDA at this point doesn't know what they're going to do. I know that for a fact. They do not know how they're going to regulate this.
The Agriculture Department won't comment except to say its proposal for catfish inspections has been submitted for review by the White House. It's been there since last November. Back at Georgia Brown's restaurant, Chef Jim Foss says catfish isn't eaten raw, so with proper cooking, there should be no problem.
I think it's like any other food item. You have to practice proper food handling techniques from how it's received to how it's stored, making sure that you're rotating your stock.
His restaurant customers continue to enjoy the southern delicacy, coated in buttermilk and fried, just down the street from White House bureaucrats who are still wrestling with catfish inspections. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
These final notes today, first of all, a clarification. I mentioned on Monday that the traders at Goldman Sachs had a perfect quarter January through March, not a single money-losing day. Turns out, that wasn't the entire story. Traders at Bank of America and JPMorgan Chase batted 1,000 as well. Also, just because a day without news of the European debt crisis is no fun at all, there is this. Eurozone economies apparently want to show the world they are still up and running despite all their problems. They said today they have carefully selected the newest member of their tiny club. Estonia has gotten the green light to start using the euro come January. Estonia, gross domestic product last year, about $23 billion, which is, I think, about what Wall Street makes in a quarter. That is Marketplace on this Wednesday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 148 points, 1.3%. The NASDAQ added 49 points, about 2%. The S&P 500 packed down 15 points. That's about 1.3%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, young Greeks mourn for their future.
I think the situation here is tragic. There's no hope, no jobs, no nothing, no future.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.